From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics this week review Men in Black International, starring Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth, and Emma Thompson. Also Shaft with Samuel L. Jackson back, along with Jesse T. Usher, and the original Shaft, Richard Roundtree. And we'll hear about Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, a documentary streaming on Netflix. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Justin Chang of the Los Angeles Times, Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom, and Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Men in Black International, directed by F. Gary Gray, screenplay from Art Markham and Matt Holloway. This is a continuation, of course, of the Men in Black franchise, two secret agents, played in this case by Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, become involved in a series of alien attacks sending them around the globe.
We are a rumor, recognizable only as deja vu and dismissed just as quickly.
We are the best kept secret in the universe.
I know.
I want in. I found you, which makes me perfect for this job.
Men in Black International. Amy, what'd you think?
You know, this is just a good quality second base blockbuster summer picture. I really laughed a lot in this. Forgot it almost as soon as it was over, but it's very cannily done, very big, bold, funny. This is a blockbuster that has almost nothing to do with the original trilogy. You see a painting of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones in an office, and that's about the extent of the references. But it's got the touchstones. It's got the black suits. It's got the neuralizers. And then the rest of it is kind of cobbled together from spare parts of what works very, very well in other franchises. You've got Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth from Thor being plugged in here as the leads and having a really great chemistry. You've got the villainess from Mission Impossible here being the villainess in this one. And I laughed a lot, to be honest. It has kind of that light, almost erotic humor in moments that you're surprised to see in a blockbuster again, where it makes you feel like, thank you. Can we make dumb movies for grown-ups that don't have to be about the fate of the world is in our hands?
Men in Black International, Justin.
Yeah, I wish I'd laughed more at this, although, yeah, I think the erotic moment you were referring to, perhaps when Chris Hemsworth wakes up from a one-night stand with some and has tentacle marks across his bulging torso,
which,
you know.
Torso.
How is that sentence going to end? You know, and I think that Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson, who, of course, appeared together in Thor Ragnarok and the Last Avengers movie, have a lot of charm, and especially Tessa Thompson, who I think is the best thing in the movie by far. Again, that is something that is very derivative about this movie. You do feel with everything that happens, it is a somewhat inferior repetition of something that you've seen before done better. And so I like the two of them together. I think his character is kind of a pill because he's this, you know, golden boy agent who's gone to seed and drinks too much and, you know, is, you know, kind of can't get his head in the game. And she is the eager to please young recruit who's very by the book and very hyper competent. And so it's about the cynical mentor training the, you know, the new girl. And yeah, I liked them a lot. I just wish that they were in something that was a little bit more interesting. I think Emma Thompson is another bright spot, and she's the only real link, I think, to the previous Men in Black 3 or even any of the other Men in Black movies.
Men in Black International, F. Gary Gray, the director, Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth star, rated PG-13 in wide release. Shaft is back, Samuel L. Jackson, Jesse T. Usher, and the original Shaft, of course, Richard Roundtree, Regina Hall in the cast, Tim Story directs, and Kenya Barris, Alex Barno are the screenwriters. Justin?
This is a very strange movie, and I think it's worth starting off by saying, you know, Shaft is now the longest running Black series character in American movies, but it's interesting because these movies are all very self-enclosed and despite having the same, you know, Roundtree's been in all of them. He played Shaft's dad in the 2000 John Singleton one, and here he's back as his uncle. So there's not a ton of inter-series continuity, inter-series, I should say.
Is there any reveal that explains that?
No, it's very slapdash, which is totally fine. But the weirdest thing about this is that they've basically taken one of the coolest, suavest characters in movie history and cast him in this multi-generational, grumpy old dad sitcom. Because he has this son who's played by Jesse T. Usher, who's the third generation of John Shaft, who he abandoned along with his mom, who's played by Regina Hall. Always lovely to see Regina Hall. And the kid is now an FBI data analyst, and so he's working for the man. And so when he finally reunites with Shaft, you know, he gives him a lot of grief for working for the man and dressing nicely. And so he gets to kind of mouth off about millennials and metrosexuals and political correctness. All this change to this just nonsense of a plot. It's like, so I guess this is the filmmaker's way of trying to make this movie relevant. And that's an interesting question. Like, why make a Shaft movie now when the character...
Because he's so cool.
He's so cool. That's true.
Isn't that really the reason for Shaft to exist?
But he's a complicated man.
I mean, here's the thing. When you make a Shaft movie in 2019, you have to acknowledge that Shaft is not cool, which to me is the most interesting thing that this film does, is you have Shaft, this absent father, mailing young Shaft. There's three Shafts. It's just multiple Shafts all over the place. And you're mailing his young son X-rated magazines. And this is a movie where the kid and his mom have to give each other an eye roll. Isn't dad lame for this? This is so retrograde. And so in those moments, I kind of found myself enjoying it for making fun of what the Shaft character looks like today. He looks like something where the coat must smell
like
mothballs.
I can't envision original Shaft, my Shaft of my my boyhood. I can't picture him doing that kind of stuff.
Mailing X-rated magazines?
Yeah.
That's not character consistent to me.
I can't believe this franchise has no consistency. What is happening?
I'm shocked.
I mean, this movie is so inconsistent, even on the inside, that it's basically just giant gunfight after giant gunfight, each one capped by the young boy saying, "I hate guns," as he grabs another gun and proceeds to blow 70 holes in the next person. What are you going to do with this movie?
But again, these actors are appealing to watch, and it's an interesting idea executed very sloppily.
I really loved Jesse T. Usher, who played young Shaft. This is the first time I've seen him in anything, and I really loved him.
All right, we're talking about Shaft. Samuel L. Jackson. I didn't intend for that. Jesse T. Usher.
Sure you didn't.
That's totally unconscious. Richard Roundtree, the original Shaft. It's rated R in wide release. Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, a documentary which is on the big screen as well as streaming on Netflix. What'd you think, Justin?
Well, the subtitle alone, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese, should tell you this movie is meant to be taken with a massive pillar of salt. Some have described it as a documentary. It's actually a very slippery weave of fact and fiction. In that respect, it's very different from Scorsese's previous Dylan documentaries, The Last Waltz and No Direction Home. This covers the 1975 Rolling Thunder tour that Dylan mounted with friends and fellow artists, including Allen Ginsberg and Joan Baez, Sam Shepard, Ramblin' Jack Elliott. They came together, you know, when the country was still reeling from Vietnam and Watergate, and Dylan imagined this incredible tour as a kind of magical return to the mythologies of America's past. He envisioned it as like a traveling circus or medicine show. And so in a lot of the concert footage, which is absolutely glorious, you'll see Dylan performing something like A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall or A Simple Twist of Fate wearing white face paint. And at a certain point, he says, "You only tell the truth when you're wearing a mask." And the movie basically takes that line as its entire conceit in terms of making you second guess what is real in this movie and what is not. He early on says, Bob Dylan says he doesn't remember anything about Rolling Thunder. It happened before I was born, which is, of course, a complete lie. but that's kind of your cue to not take this not seriously, but not necessarily factually. There are talking heads in the movie who are treated like documentary subjects, but as you're watching them, you realize that they're, in fact, fictional. The footage of the tour itself and the performances exist because Dylan had a camera crew to shoot his 1978 art film, Rinaldo and Clara. But here it's credited to a filmmaker who is completely fictional. So Scorsese and Dylan are being incredibly playful here. And, you know, hardcore Dylanologists, of whom I am not one, will probably have a field day dissecting this, picking it apart, and maybe, you know, poking, you know, getting angry about some of the liberties. But it's all very Dylan-esque because Dylan, of course, is the most slippery of popular entertainers when it comes to identity. And as a, you know, and he's a spinner of tall tales, and that is very much the essence and the heart of this movie.
So is it almost like Bob Dylan with Spinal Tap? I mean,
there is very much a Christopher Guest kind of element to some of it, but it's also done, you know, a little more seamlessly than that, or seamless in the sense of like it doesn't cue you in quite. It's a very gradual, I'm watching this and Sharon Stone is in this movie, and oh, I didn't know Sharon Stone was part of the tour. Wait, was she on the tour? Wait, what? What's the story she's telling? But it really feeds into this idea of the way in which myths become made and printing the legend, you know, so it works really well, I think.
Rolling Thunder Review, a Bob Dylan story by Martin Scorsese. You can see it on the big screen at the Vintage Los Feliz, as well as Lemley's Monica Film Center. It's also streaming on Netflix. The film is unrated. Funan is a French animated feature which stars Bérénice Bejo. You remember her, of course, from The Artist. Denis Doe is the director and also the co-screenwriter. Charles, what did you think of Funan?
Well, this is a very interesting film, very different from what we think of as animation. It is not some glorious fairy tale with musical numbers. It's based on Doe's family story about how his relatives escaped from the Khmer Rouge when Pol Pot and his thugs took over in Cambodia. It's primarily his mother's story, and he said he wanted to do it in animation as he felt the animated figure would be truer to her and a more universal figure than a live actress would be. The family is taken away from their homes, and as they're being herded along, the mother and her husband are separated from their young son, and she spends the next several years desperately trying to find out what's become of him. He's been sent to a re-education camp to make him a good little revolutionary.
He's just four, right?
Thereabouts, yeah. And it's several years, so he's absent from his parents during those crucial years. They finally are reunited and are able to escape to freedom. It's very moving. It's very minimal. It's drawn animation, drawn on Wacom tablets, I assume. Handsomely colored, but a dark, serious, brooding kind of film. I would not be surprised if it got an Oscar nomination, as there for several years now, we've had the more artistic, individual kinds of films like the Cartoon Saloon films or My Life as a Zucchini, you know, getting some representation in that category. And as so many of the big studio animated films this year have been disappointments, this is a very strong, very powerful film, not for children, not something that's going to send you out, you know, with a spring in your step and a song in your heart, but a reminder of just how powerful animation can be in presenting a message that might be too grim or too difficult to do in live action.
We're talking about the animated feature Funan from director Denis Doe, who co-wrote the screenplay. The film is unrated, but as you just heard Charles say, it is for adult audiences, not for kids. You can see it at the Lemley Glendale Cinemas. Again, the film is unrated. The Palestinian movie The Reports on Sarah and Salim is directed by Muayyad Anlayan. Justin, what do you think of this film?
I thought this was a very tense and engrossing and well-acted movie. It's set in present-day Jerusalem, and it explores what happens when an illicit love affair crosses social and political lines. It's the second feature by Palestinian director Muayyad Alayan, and it tells the story of a Palestinian man named Salim, who's played by Adib Safari, who becomes involved with an Israeli woman named Sarah. She's played by Savin Kretschner. There are class distinctions here. Salim is a poor delivery man who has a pregnant wife at home, while Sarah owns a cafe and has a daughter with her husband, who's a rising figure in the Israeli army, and his job is investigating terrorist activity. So the movie's about how a kind of James M. Cain-like situation like this, but because of the setting and because of the milieu, the personal is incredibly political. Sarah and Salim are spotted together one night in Bethlehem. And from that single tragic accident, events spiral out of control in ways that no one could anticipate. And so this is a domestic melodrama that is also very much a critique of the Israeli-Palestinian crisis and especially the occupation, the way the police detain Salim and basically turn him into a scapegoat and accuse him of being a terrorist, which he is not. And then they accuse him of trying to seduce this Israeli woman onto his side. It's very even-handed and sympathetic to all of its characters, and it's a sad look at how an impossible situation becomes even more impossible.
And strong performances.
Very, very well acted by everyone.
The reports on Sarah and Salim, unrated. It's at Lemley's Theaters, the Royal West LA Playhouse, Pasadena Town Center in Encino, and the screenplay written by the director's brother, Rami Musa Alayan. We have many more films to come. We're back in just 1 minute on Film Week. Always a pleasure to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, and Justin Chang. Next up, The Dead Don't Die, a horror fantasy comedy from writer-director Jim Jarmusch. Stars Bill Murray, Adam Driver, Tilda Swinton, Chloe Sevigny, and many, many more in the ensemble cast. Amy, what'd you think of The Dead Don't Die?
Yeah, this is a strange little film that I've been thinking about a lot, you know, because it comes on like a giant, strange slapstick comedy, which you're like, oh, okay, Jim Jarmusch, I'm interested in this, with Bill Murray and Adam Driver driving around as the local cops of the small town called Centerville as the zombie horde approaches. There's very, very heavy nods to Romero, to everybody who's like obsessed with the zombie genre. All of that stuff is in here. And then as the film progresses, it gets stranger and stranger. And I walked away being like, oh, wow, this is the angriest movie I've seen all year. This is Jim Jarmusch putting a very strong environmentalist stance in the middle of a zombie movie, kind of like layering it underneath. Because, you know, a zombie movie is always about something else. Like, what are the zombies representing here? And here, it really nails this feeling of facing a horde of zombies is like facing the collapse of the planet. It's like facing climate change. It's like, what do you do when there's a giant problem that you alone probably can't solve? Because most zombie movies end badly. And so this is a movie that is... I can see it being very hit or miss for people, but I walked away like kind of just thinking about it over and over and over again.
It doesn't sound particularly comedic, but it is funny too.
I can't. It's hard for me to imagine it's trying to be funny. What
yeah,
do you think?
It is, but the laughs in typical Jarmuschian fashion, I think, are sort of doled out at this very leisurely pace. I admire this movie, and I wanted to like it more in the moment. I have also been thinking about it a lot. I love Jarmusch's films, and I especially love his previous genre experiment, the vampire movie Only Lovers Left Alive, which is so great. Here, he's made what you might call an undeadpan comedy.
It's a gimme.
Come on, guys. So it's very droll, but very bleak at the same time. And there are these very obvious political signifiers that Amy mentions, like Steve Buscemi plays the town bigot who wears this red cap that says, "Keep America White Again." And it's like, that's literally what it says.
So.
And the zombie epidemic is blamed on rampant polar fracking, which has thrown the Earth off balance, and now the sun doesn't set, or it sets at the wrong time. And what Jarmusch is basically saying is that we are this nation of zombies. We're lazy, and we're inattentive, and we're doomed, and the planet is dying no matter how much we try to fight back. And so you're not – but the result is that the movie feels like a shrug. And you could say that that's a good thing. I guess it's a fitting thing because that's his attitude toward it. But it also feels a little maybe like it's lacking in a certain urgency that I wanted. So it's an interesting – though. You know, we've seen a lot of revisionist genre riffs and things too. It's not like this is the first iteration of this kind of thing. But it is interesting given Jarmusch's sensibility.
Jim Jarmusch's film The Dead Don't Die. Jarmusch, the writer, director, Bill Murray and Adam Driver star with Tilda Swinton and Chloe Sevigny. It's rated R in select theaters. Murder Mystery, an action mystery comedy starring Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. Kyle Nowacek, the director, and James Vanderbilt wrote the screenplay. Amy.
Yeah, I find Murder Mystery, this movie, fascinating for a couple reasons. Because, you know, in 2011, you have Jennifer Aniston and Adam Sandler pairing together for, like, a caper movie abroad called Just Go With It, which makes, like, $200 million at the box office. And now we have a movie not that different, but it exists on Netflix, which is sort of a fine place for a lazy-ish, sort of charming, I don't know, film like this. The plot here is that Adam Sandler is a cop, a very bad husband, who finally, after 10 years of being married to Jennifer Aniston, is strong-armed into taking her to Europe for the first time. And she meets a rich man on the plane, played by Luke Evans, doing his kind of dastardly villain thing that he's very good at, and he's very good at it here. He invites them onto a yacht owned by his uncle, who owns a $70 billion fortune. And of course, the uncle gets stabbed before they get to eat dinner. And this movie, I suppose, is an indictment of the French cops, who immediately assume that Aniston and Sandler are to blame. And of course, hijinks ensue, giant car crash, everything you're expecting. And yet, you know, it's very knowingly Agatha Christie goofy, I guess. You've got Gemma Arterton as an actress on the ship. There's a race car driver and a Maharaja. You know, there's everybody. There's a colonel with one eye. And, you know,
tons of people. Seagoing Orient Express.
It is. In fact, it makes a very deliberate nod to that toward the end. I mean, I don't have a ton of patience for the Adam Sandler shtick, where he walks into a movie and he's like, I'm lazy and I don't like to try and I'm terrible, but I'll show you that by the end of this movie, I'll be proven to be the smartest man on this boat. And you're like, oh, God. But Jennifer Aniston, I thought, was actually really great. I found myself rewatching some of her scenes because she's giving an actual performance in a movie that you're like, you didn't have to do this.
Murder mystery, Justin.
Jennifer Aniston is so consistently great, I think, in a lot of comedies that really let her down, because the material just, again, is not very funny. It's a weird script by James Vanderbilt, whose best credit by far is Zodiac, you know, the mother of true crime police procedurals, and clearly a talented writer, knows his way around a plot. And the things that I liked best about this movie, it's weird too. I am actually very much the target audience for this, because I kind of love
old
school.
You're an Adam Sandler fan?
I am an up and down appreciator of sometimes when Adam Sandler makes a good movie every decade or so. But I love old school detective novels, and I love the kind of I kind of like the idea as well, Amy, that Netflix is now investing in the kinds of movies that Hollywood used to crank out by the dozen. These very geeky, creaky, puzzle solving, you know, body in a library type of thing. And yet, so I was sort of grooving on some of that, but it's not a painful movie. It's very pleasant. The locations look great. They're in Monte Carlo. They're in Lake Como. They're in Malaga. But I just, you know, Sandler, who I sometimes find very hard to take, is actually perfectly fine, I think, doing, again, very familiar shtick. It's just not very funny in the end.
Murder Mystery is streaming on Netflix. It's rated PG-13. 5B, a documentary about the AIDS ward of San Francisco General Hospital. The film is directed by Dan Krause and Paul Haggis. Charles?
Well, this is depressing and infuriating and necessary. Ward 5B was the first facility dedicated to care of AIDS patients before the name AIDS had been coined, before the HIV virus had been identified. And many caregivers were terrified, not knowing what to do with these patients. They couldn't cure them. They were afraid to go near them in some cases. And apparently some of the nurses and caregivers at this hospital were shooting footage that they've saved all this time. And one of the things that they did that upset a lot of the medical establishment was they would touch the patients. There's a heartbreaking scene where a man says to the nurse, "No one's touched me in a year." Mm-hmm. And you also see infuriating things like Ronald Reagan finally using the term AIDS after 27,000 citizens of the country he's supposed to preside over have died. So it's infuriating when you see the bigotry and the ignorance and the hatred that these people had to find. And you end up just wanting to give some awards to these caregivers who help the least of us.
How's the filmmaking aside from
skillful? No, I mean, they found a lot of old footage, and they found these same nurses and caregivers who are remembering and talking, and it ties it all together in a very moving package. You know, my voice is breaking thinking about some of the moments in this film. So it's very, very effective, but again, not a cheery film.
Powerful documentary, 5B. It's rated PG-13 in select theaters. The drama American Woman stars Sienna Miller, Christina Hendricks, and Aaron Paul. Jake Scott directs from Brad Ingleby's script. Amy?
I will lay my cards out at the start of this review. I think Sienna Miller is our greatest underappreciated actress, and this movie is another tribute to that. I mean, what this film is about is Sienna Miller plays a woman who's in her early 30s at the start, and it's a character study of her growing up as an adult. You know, she was a teen mom who then had a teenage daughter who was a teen mom herself. And so in the very beginning of the movie, her young daughter disappears and leaves her with the boy and never comes back. And so you watch her deal with this loss over years and years and years in this small town where she lives literally across the street from her sister, Christina Hendricks, who gives a lot of unwanted advice, but also help. You know, they have a very good, complex, and I think credible sisterly relationship. And really, this film is just about watching Sienna Miller go through so many changes, try to get her life on order, go from a drunken party girl to something sort of mature. And she makes a lot of mistakes. She makes a lot of mistakes along the way. She gets married to a patriarchal creep played by Pat Healy. But you care so much about her. You really just love this woman. And I was knocked out absolutely by this performance. You're like, you want to reach into the screen and just grab Sienna Miller and be like, you are such a screw up and I want things to be okay for you.
American Woman, starring Sienna Miller. It's rated R at Lemley's Playhouse Pasadena and the AMC in Century City. The documentary from Brazil, The Edge of Democracy, is directed by Petra Costa. The film is unrated. Justin?
Yeah, this works very well, I think, as both a primer on the tumultuous last several years of Brazilian politics and also as a very passionate personal essay film. It covers the period starting with the rise of former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and his succession by President Dilma Rousseff, both from the country's Workers' Party. Today, of course, Lula is in prison, having been convicted of corruption and money laundering, and Rousseff was impeached, and far-right President Jair Bolsonaro is in power. The documentary will resonate with anyone who is noticing and who is alarmed by the rise of right-wing nationalism all over the world, whether it's the Trump administration or Brexit or many countries in Europe. It's especially poignant here because, as the title suggests, Brazilian democracy was such a new and fragile and seemingly short-lived concept. This is a country that endured years of brutal military dictatorship and that imported slaves from Africa, and it didn't embrace democracy until the 80s. And Petra Costa, the filmmaker, points out that she and Brazilian democracy are kind of the same age, and her parents were both liberal activists who were exiled and imprisoned at different points. And so when candidates like Lula came along, Lula was working class and he was leader of a steelworkers union. It really felt like a dream come true for them and other people. So it's very fiery, very vital stuff. It's about the way nuance is lost when populist politics and a mob mentality takes over. It's pretty gripping.
It's going to be on screen at Lemley's Monica Film Center next Wednesday, June 19th. And it's streaming on Netflix, The Edge of Democracy, unrated. The Raft is the story of an anthropological experiment from 1973. It's a documentary with footage from the experiment. It's directed by Marcus Lindin. Amy.
This documentary is fascinating. So what happened is in 1973, there was a social anthropologist who worked out of Mexico. He was on a plane and the plane got hijacked. And it made him think, I need to study the origins of anger and of human aggression. So his strategy, because this is the 70s and we're learning how to do experiments, is he built a raft and he put 13 people on it, himself, a cameraman, and then seven women, I think, or slightly more women than men. And he did all of these things that he's very open about. We have his tapes. We have somebody reading his audio diaries. We have original footage of the ship saying that he did calculated things like everybody had to be hot, but everybody had to be married because he wanted to figure out when people are going to have tension with each other.
Sounds like reality TV.
It's a lot like reality TV. And what he finds out really surprised him. And so then he starts messing with the experiment. And when he starts messing with the experiment, this film got really dark and really fascinating. And what they've done here to make it seem visual, even in the present, is beyond the documentary footage, they've rebuilt the raft to scale out of wood. And all the survivors are now on the raft as older people walking around, living through their memories, being like, you slept here, I slept here. Do you remember when we talked about killing someone? And it's really worth a watch.
The Raft, the documentary from director Marcus Lindin at Lemley's Glendale Cinema. The film is unrated. Coming up, we'll hear from Justin about the Locarno Film Festival in Los Angeles. And we'll also talk about the blockbusters that never were. Big budget movies that were total duds. We'll talk about that as we continue right after this.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Before we talk about Dark Phoenix, the X-Men movie that bombed and its projected huge losses and where that fits with other bombs, we do want to talk about a film that Justin Chang has alerted us to in the past, a 14-and-a-half-hour Argentinian epic, La Flor.
Yes. This is playing, starts tonight. Get your tickets now.
All in one sitting?
Not in one sitting, although that would be a, you know, it's most conversations about this movie start with the extreme length. But of course, 14 and a half hours is nothing in the binging era. Think about it as the new Netflix 10-parter that just dropped. You know, so in your living room, yeah. It's playing at the Lemley Music Hall over the next 3 days. It is a commitment. I went through it myself, and I am a richer person for it. This is a film from the Argentinian director Mariano Ginas, and it's playing as part of the Locarno in Los Angeles festival, which is basically the Locarno Film Festival is held every fall, and this is a selection of highlights from that festival, films receiving their LA premieres. This La Flor is, I'll be brief, even though the movie is not. It's six episodes. Five of the six feature the same quartet of lead actresses, and it is basically a fantasia on cinema. They're playing different roles throughout. Part one is a mummy horror sci-fi film. Part two is this musical melodrama. Part three is a 5.5-hour spy thriller in which all four of them play assassins, and you get to know each one's backstory. Found it completely riveting. And then part four and five and six just get increasingly weird and meta. It's a hoot. It's an intellectual feast. It's great storytelling, and it's about storytelling. And I don't think you should miss it if you love movies and you live in L.A.
La Flor, the Argentinian epic at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills as a part of the Locarno in L.A. Film Festival. Well, Dark Phoenix, as I was mentioning, an X-Men film that completely bombed. Our critics warned you about the movie, and apparently people heeded that warning. With us to talk about where Dark Phoenix sits compared to other big-budget bombs of the past, Sean Fennessy, editor-in-chief, chief content officer at the sports and pop culture website The Ringer. He also is the host of the Big Picture podcast. Sean, thank you for joining us.
Larry, it's my pleasure.
So what went wrong with Dark Phoenix?
Ooh, where to begin? Virtually everything. I suppose it starts back in 2000 when there was an X-Men movie, but we find ourselves almost 20 years later at the conclusion, theoretically, of this saga. And the film is what feels like many films Frankenstein together. And as you guys talked about last week, this movie does not work, and critics know that it does not work. But more so, I think fans know that it doesn't work. And it's the victim of a series of complex industry and creative problems. We've got a movie that is at the mercy of a merger between Fox and Disney. We've got a movie that has been shot and then reshot and then reshot once more. We've got a movie that has changed character names, alien races that have been redefined midstream. We've just got a series of quagmires throughout the production of the film, and I think audiences smelled it a long ways away.
So I've seen that the estimate is it could lose $100 to $120 million.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing to, I think, try to understand. As all of you guys know, the way we receive information about what the budget of a film is a bit opaque. So sometimes we hear a movie cost $150 million. What does that mean? Does that mean every single dollar was spent on the making of the movie? Sometimes. It depends on how the studio delivers that information to us. Sometimes there's the marketing budget, which can exceed $30, $40, $50 million for certain films. So how much information we have publicly makes it hard to understand. Did this movie lose $100 million? Did it lose $150 million? We'll never actually know the truth of that number, but Dark Phoenix has been reported to have cost $200 million. It has already made worldwide $145 million. That seems not so bad, but all of those hidden costs that we're not talking about, that we don't understand, make this seem like a bigger failure.
So, Amy Nicholson, do you have nominations for biggest bombs of all time?
Is it wrong to start off by saying that I kind of am fascinated by bombs as a whole because to me what a bomb is, great, then I'm right in my zone. Because what I think is so fascinating about a bomb and what kind of draws me to film in general as an anthropologist is a giant studio movie like Dark Phoenix is saying, we think we know what the American people want. I have a gamble on what's in the zeitgeist. I have a feeling about what they're willing to spend their money on. And when they're wrong, it's fascinating because it's kind of a snapshot of what we care about as audiences, which is why as a critic, I've always been as interested in blockbuster films as indie films. And so with that in mind, like, I'm excited that superhero movies are bombing. Is that okay? Can I just say that out loud?
Totally. Sure.
Yes. You won't get an argument.
It was reassuring when Solo bombed last year because it's like, because when it was a terrible movie, and it was good to know that even Star Wars is not infallible.
All right.
Well, and remember, George Lucas also brought us Strange Magic.
I don't remember that, actually.
Yeah, lucky you.
Charles, you have any animated versions of bombs to share?
There was Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within, that had a built-in audience of tens of millions from the games. It was a complete bomb, took down the studio with it. Titan AE was another one that ended Fox Animation.
Now, that's something. That's quite a credit to be so bad that you actually destroyed the studio that made it.
Yes. Lost something like $100 million and is one of the very worst films Don Bluth ever made.
Wow.
So, which is saying something.
Well, and quickly along those lines, too, Heaven's Gate, you know, which, you know, the much maligned and for many grievously misunderstood Michael Cimino epic, which famously bankrupted United Artists.
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, and so you say famously misunderstood. Some of the bombs have actually had a kind of renewed appreciation. That's one.
Heaven's Gate has absolutely undergone, I think, a critical reclamation. So has Ishtar.
Yeah, we're in such an Elaine moment, an Elaine May moment. And I think Ishtar is finally getting its due, which is sort of nice to see.
Because that was always the film where it was theorized the people making it were having so much fun that it left the audience out and there was nothing left for the people watching it to enjoy. Sean, what do you stand out as some of the biggest bombs of all time?
Well, I guess the world historical classic is Cleopatra, the 1963 Liz Taylor adaptation, which is not a good film and also quite long, not quite as long as that 14-hour film.
It feels it.
It does. The thing that's interesting, though, and you mentioned Heaven's Gate, and I think you can point to The Cotton Club, the Francis Ford Coppola film. You can talk about Ishtar. You can talk about Bonfire of the Vanities. The thing that is different about some of those movies is there was a lot of journalism and attention paid on them, and I think the reclamation project is because we understand the arc of the failure. And now, with a lot of the movies that fail, you mentioned Solo. You know, you can think of a frivolous movie like R.I.P.D., which was a very bad Ryan Reynolds, Jeff Bridges movie that came out in 2013. No one saw that movie and no one cared. There was no journalism about why that movie failed. It just didn't work and it wasn't interesting. And the films in the 70s and 80s that tended to fail were part of a different kind of industry. Much of the movie industry now is owned by massive corporations. And so there is an expectation that they have to make a huge number. It's not personal. It's not a small business anymore. And when it was a smaller business, it felt more fun and more interesting to understand why Liz Taylor flopped so badly. And we're just in a different movie economy.
And is it harder to understand today international exhibition than in the past? I mean, particularly what, say, Chinese filmgoers are going to appreciate.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, we mentioned Dark Phoenix earlier. Dark Phoenix has made $140 million. $100 million has come internationally. That was just not a part of the calculus even 25 years ago. China wasn't showing American films in their theaters 12 years ago. So we find ourselves in an interesting moment for what is a flop. Solo made quite a bit of money, but did it make enough money? What is enough money? How do we legislate what is a success now?
And that's one reason for the popularity of the comic book type movies is that violence plays everywhere. There are different attitudes about romance or comedy in other parts of the world, but the good guy shooting the bad guy with 70 bullets, as Amy counted, that plays anywhere.
Well, you know, important to mention, too, in the case of Solo, I mean, this is not going to kill off Star Wars films. And Dark Phoenix, its disastrous showing is not going to kill off Marvel films, certainly. So the genre is going to continue.
I think what's interesting about it is this might be the best thing that could have happened to X-Men. I think people forgetting that this was a version of X-Men is what Disney wants.
We'll continue with Sean Fennessy, joining us from The Ringer, where he's editor-in-chief and chief content officer. He's the host of the Big Picture podcast as well, along with our Amy Nicholson, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. We'll talk about the biggest bombs in movie history as we continue on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Our critics with us this week are Justin Chang, Charles Solomon, and Amy Nicholson, and also joining us for our conversation about the biggest bombs in film of all time, Sean Fennessy of The Ringer, the sports and pop culture website. You can also put your nomination for the biggest film bomb of all time on our Film Week page at kpcc.org. Sean, you have a list of bombs here beyond Cleopatra.
Should we talk about some more recent failures?
Yeah, let's do that.
There was a little bit of chatter about The Lone Ranger, Gore Verbinski's 2013 Johnny Depp adaptation.
That was painful.
Not a great success.
I would say it was an underappreciated film.
I would agree.
I think Armie Hammer really understood that character. What are you going to do with a gigantic, handsome man like Armie Hammer except make a joke out of how wonderful he is?
I agree. I tend to like the movie, and I think the reclamation of these movies is a fascinating thing that happens and how they live on.
We don't have enough movies with horses running across trains and buildings.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, like, to Sean's point about the conversations around the films of the 60s and 70s and what we have today, that I think can be more destructive is Twitter buzz, which just sort of starts. Like, it started around RIPD and it started around Lone Ranger that it was going to be bad before anybody ever really saw it. And that just solidifies for some reason into a fact before the movie comes out.
And troubled production often is read, oh, the film is going to be a mess. Mm-hmm. But that's not always the case. Sometimes, you know, films that you hear were difficult productions actually end up as gems.
You know what's an interesting—
Ratatouille.
That's right. Yeah. That's an interesting version of that, too, is we talked about Solo. And Rogue One was another Star Wars film that came out a few years ago, which also had a very similarly troubled production. The director was replaced. It was rewritten halfway through. But we didn't know that before the movie came out. And so when we saw the film, we thought, oh, this must have been a rosy production. We knew the directors of Solo were fired halfway through the production of that film. So that does matter with how we perceive it.
And last year, the opposite case with Bohemian Rhapsody, a hugely troubled production that became a record-breaking, like a smash.
That's
so
exactly right.
We're all so
happy about it.
And I think it doesn't matter if it's a great filmmaker making the movie. We saw the Wachowskis in 2008 made Speed Racer, which is a film that a lot of people admire to this day, but was a massive bomb, hugely failed. Well, I guess the color and the excitement and the verve aesthetics of that film.
But it was a movie about racing, and you had no idea where they were in the race.
It's true. It was experimental. Yeah. It's always hard to say what's not going to work. I think it was evident that like something like Battlefield Earth, though, was not going to work.
Battlefield Earth, the John Travolta film that was a real personal project for him from an L. Ron Hubbard story.
Yes, and I think the minute you saw the trailer, I think most people knew this is not for me. This doesn't look very good.
One of the biggest bombs from Guy Ritchie was King Arthur, Legend of the Sword. And again, you said sometimes opaque to get the financial information, but the estimate I'm looking at is $150 million loss from that film.
And sometimes it doesn't matter because Guy Ritchie immediately got a job and began to direct Aladdin for Disney. So sometimes it's not held against the filmmaker. You never can tell.
Maybe it should be.
But I do think it's interesting that sometimes the perception of a bomb is the truth, even when the numbers don't back it up. I mean, you guys know that I'm obsessed with Tom Cruise. And there's this idea that his career tanked in 2005, you know, the year of Oprah, when he jumped on the couch. But the Oprah jumping on the couch thing happened right before he opened War of the Worlds, which is actually his biggest hit. But if you ask anybody, that's the year his career died.
Who would guess that was his biggest hit?
His biggest box office hit. It was right when everybody said his career was over, and he ended up getting fired from Paramount that year. His production company had to leave the studio because there was this perception he was a flop, even though he'd never done better.
All right. Any other films, Justin, that you want to add to this list?
It's a Wonderful Life was perceived as a huge flop, barely recouping its budget when it grossed only $3.3 million when it opened. And it is now, of course, a holiday perennial. So.
Yeah, Casablanca was seen as a surefire bomb, and it happened one night. Claudette Colbert dismissed that. when she finished it.
So a lot of these perceptions really are not necessarily true.
But I will say, I mean, to that point, you know, I do a podcast where we're going through the AFI Top 100, and over half of the films on that list were the number one film of that year, which I find to be a little depressing.
Oh, yeah.
The idea that box office clout really does define what films we remember. It's the outliers that are the films.
See,
like
I would choose to look at the opposite. Well, maybe people's taste, the general public, is better than critics want to give it credit for. Yeah. Yeah, maybe it's sort of an anti-elitism.
Yeah, hey, Larry, try getting folks off the street to do this show.
Bill, we do have elite critics. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley wants to bring up the Disney film John Carter, which was a massive loser. And that one that was, you know, rather eagerly anticipated at some point.
It was Andrew Stanton.
Yeah, absolutely. Before the behind-the-scenes news started coming out.
Yeah, and we think of Disney as this indestructible force, this train that cannot be stopped. But we're talking about John Carter. We're talking about Solo. We're talking about movies that they made that just did not work.
A Wrinkle in Time.
Yeah, A Wrinkle in Time last year. And no one is impervious to this kind of failure.
Well, I remember when Eddie Murphy was riding high and, you know, his movie's doing so well. And then he does The Adventures of Pluto Nash, which lost nearly $100 million.
The Haunted Mansion didn't exactly burn up the box office either.
Yeah. So, I mean, this was after Beverly Hills Cop, Trading Places, Nutty Professor, terrific film, Dr. Doolittle. Yeah. So all of that for Eddie Murphy. Again, you can nominate your biggest box office bomb on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. Rob mentions after the original Star Wars, Disney tried to answer with Black Hole. What was the name of that?
The Black Hole.
It was The Black Hole.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, a forgettable film.
Yes, that was also around the time they did The Black Cauldron, too.
Is that is The Black Hole a description of what happened to its prophet?
Pretty much.
With us, Sean Fennessy of The Ringer. Sean, do you have some other titles to add to our bomb list here?
Well, I'm curious about, from the critics, actually, if a movie fails, does that recontextualize how you think about it? Do you have any kind of empathy for a performance around a movie? Because we can list 100 of these films, but I think that we're never going to know the truth of how much they've lost. But the way that they live on is a part of the problem here.
Well, to Amy's point earlier, which is that we all pay too much attention to box office now, I think, even as with companies like Netflix in the mix, how well a movie's actually doing becomes is not being reported.
Unknowable.
So, you know, but something like, I remember this Danny Boyle's movie Steve Jobs from 2015, which I actually think is a terrific picture.
Love that.
And
really?
As with every movie we've now named here that you kind of hate, Charles. Steve Jobs, I think, is a terrific movie that, you know, fell so short of expectations that in a lot of the conversations, even with colleagues, there was this reverse perception like, oh, yeah, that was bad. It just didn't work. And it's like, no, actually, it worked quite well. It just fell short of expectations. And so it shouldn't be, you know, if you don't like the movie, that's one thing. But I think there's sometimes this reverse correction where we're looking at, you know, where we mistakenly call something bad just because it didn't pay off financially.
I would agree with that. Even this week, the buzz on Shaft was so bad. And Justin and I both had to go buy a ticket and see it last night at the midnight showings.
Oh, critics were not invited to special screenings.
They were, but we couldn't make them.
Couldn't. Yeah. Okay.
And I will say for myself, I was absolutely dreading seeing Shaft because the buzz on it was so bad. And I was much more positive than I expected.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
So it made you, in having the bar being lowered for you, made you a bit...
I know.
Kinder
how am I just
going
to review in a bubble? That seems the safest.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Our Film Week critics this week, Amy Nicholson, Justin Chang, and Charles Solomon. Our thanks to Sean Fennessy. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it very much. Editor-in-Chief, Chief Content Officer at the pop culture and sports website and podcast network The Ringer. He hosts the Big Picture podcast. Have a terrific weekend from all of us at Film Week. I'll be away for our next Film Week program, and a guest host will be filling in for me. I have a lot of movies coming out next week. We'll get to those. You'll hear all about them on the next Film Week. Here on 89.3 KPCC.